Advices Radio Network.
Advices Radio is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The opinions of the host are not meant to be taken as medical advice. If you have a health concern, see a doctor immediately.
When it comes to the day of the contest, I'm his father. He comes to me for advices. So it's not that hard for me to give him the wrong advices.
The wrong advices.
What's up, guys, and welcome to Advices Radio. I'm your host, Scott McNally. You're listening to episode number 54, and today I have with me Kate DeNunzio. She has a company called The Art of Progress Change Management, and that is going to be the focus of our topic today, change. Change is something that we can all try to strive to get better at. Kate works with businesses as well as individuals, helping them to increase their resiliency. So Kate breaks change down into smaller, digestible chunks so we can better understand what's going on in our heads during this process. I hope that this program is beneficial to everybody out there and that it helps you to reach your goals. Let's get to the program. Welcome back to Advices Radio. I'm your host, Scott McNally, and welcome to 2018. This is our first episode of the year. I thought this would be exceptionally interesting considering everybody always wants to make changes and set new goals for 2018. Today, we are talking with Kate DeNunzio. Her company is called The Art of Progress Change Management Consulting. Kate, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
So not only do you run this business, and we'll get to it in just a minute, but you're also very familiar with what we do in fitness. You are a competitive bodybuilder as well, correct?
I am so. I've been bodybuilding for just over 4 years now.
So you do you specifically consider yourself a bodybuilder, or do you do women's physique, or where do you fit on the spectrum? Are you like legit hardcore, I am a bodybuilder?
I am legit hardcore. I am a bodybuilder. You couldn't pay me to put sequins on the suit or shoes on the feet.
Wow. Wow. All right. So you'll fit right in with us here. change is our topic today. Let's just get started here then. How is this all going to relate to bodybuilding today?
Well, I think, Scott, you know, that's a really great question. I feel like the fitness industry and bodybuilding is a ripe area for applying methodical change management. I often tell people that the very best athletes, the ones who are the most successful, are masters at managing change. And that's based off of things like our biofeedback. It's based off of things like coaching feedback on a regular weekly basis, being able to rationalize changes such as reduced macronutrients or enhanced or increased cardio or changes to our programming to help us become more successful.
Yeah.
It's very applicable.
I can see that. And tell me a little bit about your business. What do you do?
So in the grand scheme, what I do is I generally work with organizations, individuals, athletes, as well as life coaching clients to help them identify where they want to go, what their end state and their vision is to be the best that they can be. In big corporate business, it can range anywhere from major technology implementations to helping thousands of people adapt to working with professional sports teams to help them understand how resiliency actually works within managing change in the structure of that organization. In terms of when I work with individuals or life coaching clients, it's really helping people unlock and tap into the full potential of what they can be and where they want to go, and helping them develop step changes that are consumable so that they don't ultimately go to failure.
Hmm.
I think to this one client who I've worked with extensively over the past several years, who really wants to lose, you know, say 75 pounds. It's usually between 75 and 85, depends which week I'm talking to her.
Okay.
And a lot of where she fails is the fact that she tries to do too much too soon, or she tries to push herself into an area that she's just really not capable of even visualizing. So when I work with a client like that, it's about making consumable change visually capable, like looking at it and saying, you know, I can record just my water today, or I can go forward and I can just record my breakfast and know exactly what I'm putting into my body, right? And it sounds very, very basic when you put it in those terms, but when somebody doesn't know where to start, they don't know where to start. And so being that guide or that Sacagawea, bringing them through the pathway is very beneficial.
I could see that. So, you know, when we started talking, I mean, this is something I feel like, initially I thought, hey, this is a great idea. And then the more we talked, the more I just saw just all these different rabbit holes we really could go down. And one of the things you showed me is this chart that is, it's called the change curve. It looks like what you're saying here is that, you know, the idea, or really change kind of starts with an idea. Am I correct with this?
Absolutely. It depends. Like if you're applying it to, say, something like a contest prep, right? The idea is I want to get on stage and I want to be the leanest person that I can be. I want to be competitive.
Okay.
You know, we instigate that change, be it through, you know, our social media influences or the desire to want to be a competitive athlete or to be better than we were last year during our last season. And I think as bodybuilders, you know, there's that me versus me kind of attitude, right? And just on a side note, it's not me versus me. It's me versus everybody else up there, right?
Like, right.
I'm pretty hardcore that way.
So. We can say it all we want, you know.
You know, it's not me versus me. I mean, I know I'm awesome. But, you know, it comes down to the fact that even when we instigate our own change, the first phase that we feel is that shock or that denial, we come down into the base of that curve and we start to come through. And it's like, wow, I can't actually believe I'm doing this. And I think, you know, as I'd mentioned to you previously, we can't skip stages on the change curve. It's human nature. It's psychology. It's the science behind how people work. And so as we come through the shock and denial, we start to feel lost. And I think every competitor can go, man, I'm so excited for my check-in. I can't wait to see what's going to happen. And then coach slashes those macros down and it's like, holy shit, I feel so lost. That's 25 grams of carbs gone.
Yeah.
What am I going to do? Right. And I mean, that again, it comes down to a basic, but when you're limiting yourself and you're really focused on those goals, that loss is very real. And it, you know, I bet you there are hundreds of people who can relate to that just in the moment of feeling that, oh shit, kind of.
Absolutely.
I can't believe this is happening. Right. And then what happens is you have to wake up to do fasted cardio and you're feeling tired because life is carrying on and you still have to manage everything around and you hit anger. And for me, when I look, I love anger. Anger is my favorite place on the change curve. Right?
Yeah.
Because you can manifest and put out all of these emotions and you can feel justified in the way that you behave. And you can be snappy with your partner and you can blow things off at work. You write mean emails and I'm on a diet and I've lost 30 grams of carbs this week. And, right? We're justified in our anger. But as a coach and as somebody who works with athletes, I love anger because I can see it. And if I can see it, it means I can help them solve it.
Interesting.
And I think where we start to see an erosion in terms of how people leverage their coaching relationship the right way, they tend not to show those emotions because they're fraught with shame. They're fraught with maybe my coach will lose respect for me. And if you can't see it, if you're checking in with somebody once a week or you don't have the finger on the pulse or you don't have a relationship with that coach or, you know, vice versa, the ability to manage anger and help people come out of the bottom of that curve and really slide up through it is a very limiting factor. And so what happens is people end up sitting in that hanging, bargaining, depression and despair at the bottom of the curve. And what happens is they sit there, and this is where athletes who really don't have the resiliency skills or don't have the management of their own personal change, where they tend to start to feel those failure points. This is where we start closet eating. This is where we start scaling back on cardio. This is where we start to see those self-depreciating habits and behaviors that stop us from being successful. And what happens is we limit ourselves there at that despair point, and we end up coming into our next week of check-in and the change is instigated again and we come through those full range of emotions right back to where we started. Hmm. And so when you see people who get up on stage and they're not in shape, I mean, certainly we look at that and we go, wow, they're not really in great shape, right? But those are the people who literally have dieted for 16 or 20 weeks and have never made it past that bottom part of the curve to fully realize what they're capable of doing through those last three stages of early engagement, buy-in, and action. And so, you know, if I look at it and I apply this to even how I've dieted with my coach for the past 3.5 years and worked with her, we have a very intimate relationship. I'll hit anger and she is the first one who knows that I'm mad. I don't like this. I didn't like what I looked like in my pictures. The scale didn't tell me what I wanted to see.
Yeah.
And God damn it, you took macros away from me because of all of that.
Mm.
And so if I articulate that and we work through the bottom part of that curve and we come up into early engagement, she might poke at me and make me feel uncomfortable.
Mm.
I hate early engagement. It's very uncomfortable because it makes us have to...
Oh, go ahead. It makes us what?
It makes us have to look at ourselves in the mirror. And it makes us have to take feedback and apply it in a way that makes us maybe feel uncomfortable.
Hmm. I would like to talk more about this. I feel like this is a spot where it sounds like I've seen myself get hung up. I obviously a lot of other people have gotten hung up. I think that'll be a great spot to dig a little bit deeper into.
Sure.
Tell me more though about the remainder of the scale. What happens next? You mentioned the term early engagement. What does that mean?
Early engagement is when we actually start to see change taking place, right? So my coach has given me feedback. I've adapted to the macronutrients, right? I check in on a Monday. By Wednesday, I'm already in early engagement.
Okay.
You know, I don't hear from my coach until Monday evening. Tuesday, it takes me the whole day to manage through this gamut of emotions. And I know everywhere I'm going to be. And by Wednesday morning, I'm in early engagement. I might have to look back at my week previous and say, man, sleeping 5 hours a night and not drinking all my water, those were really bad moves, right? That's what helped me get all the slashes, right? So early engagement is one of those things where it feels like people are making it very personal, but it's not. What it is it's somebody, in this example, a coach is putting their fingerprints all over your program. You've given them the ability to do that, right? And so what happens is as you start to come through that and you say, okay, you know what? It looks okay. I'm willing to test it. I'm going to give it a try because, you know what, I'm paying this person for a reason. I trust them, right? They know what they're doing. And then we come into buy-in. And now, buy-in is one of those things. People throw this term around a lot. You know, you just need to buy in, right? It's not like salt. You can't just run down to the market and grab buy-in.
Okay.
It takes effort. It takes a lot of effort. It takes the effort on part of the coacher and the coachee. And when we can both see where one another are coming from, creating buy-in and going into it, right? So I say Wednesday morning, I come into early engagement. By Wednesday afternoon, I am ticking along and the plan is fully in process. I am in buy-in because that's where I need to be in order to be successful. And so from there, it becomes action. And when we can create action, even out of the things that make us feel a little uncomfortable or push us out of that comfort zone, that's where we can truly be competitive, right? The true point of failure and change comes from being uncomfortable and being willing to drive through that.
So action is the final spot. This curve, you said, you know, we can't skip steps. We all go through this. I think that there are some people out there that are more in tune with what they're feeling than others. I think that this could be a really interesting podcast, especially for people who maybe aren't as in touch with what they're feeling and they're going through these things. I feel like just understanding this, I could get a little bit better of a sense of control as to what's happening.
Absolutely. And that's the thing is that, you know, there's certain things that you can apply to each element of this change curve, right? And as I was mentioning to you in some of our earlier communications, there are a number of different things that I take and blend into this to help manage these things, right? So you've heard me use the term resiliency.
Yeah.
Resiliency is four things. That's all it is. It's four little things. And the four things are problem solving, empathy, emotional regulation, and self-confidence.
Okay.
And these are behaviors and things that should be embedded in us and grown within us and nurtured within us from the time we're born. And arguably, that's a pretty broad statement, and I think it's very much not a reality. I think that a lot of people lack in resiliency, and even more so now because of the introduction of social media, the use of social media, how people are addicted to their social media.
Explain this to me. What's the correlation here?
Well, I think when you look at it, and I mean, I'm very guilty of this in my own. Like, if you were to look at my Instagram, you'll notice that since June, I've themed it out. So if I can't fit a post into my theme, I don't post.
Okay.
And what that does is it stops me from being on social media too much. It's very deliberate. And the reason I've done that is because I found myself comparing my body, who I am, what my prep looks like, my journey to everybody else. And so what that was doing was it was creating an erosion in my self-confidence, my capability, right? What am I actually capable of achieving? As a natural female bodybuilder, there's really only so much that I can do, even in a full year of really, like, really heavy lifting to build my physique. I truly cannot be as competitive as a woman who is using gear in a year,
sure.
Right? I mean, that's just the reality.
Sure.
But I'm comparing myself to these women,
okay.
Right? So when you look at the factors of resiliency, I'll say, okay, great, I want to look like that person, but it's not possible for me to look like that person without putting 6 more years of effort in.
Sure.
And that's just the reality. So my self-confidence starts to get eroded. And then what starts to happen is maybe I stop feeling really great and my emotional regulation then becomes impacted. So I'm feeling agitated because I'm already dieting, I'm working really hard, I'm doing everything I need to be doing. Maybe the scale's not budging. I feel lean, but maybe I feel small and flat.
Yeah.
Right? So now my self-confidence is now going to hit my emotional regulation. I'm going to be shorter with people than I need to be, right? My empathy is going to be reduced for those around me. Maybe my empathy towards myself is going to be reduced, which is going to increase my shame factor in the fact that maybe I didn't weigh my peanut butter. I just took a huge dollop, right?
Sounds good.
It all starts to come there. And then what happens is it starts to impact and impede my problem-solving capability.
I see.
So when I start to come up against a problem, what happens is I'm either not going to deal with the problem, I'm not going to deal with the problem effectively, I'm going to lose emotional regulation, and my problem-solving skills are going to be rendered useless because people won't want to work with me. Maybe I damage relationships. So in every aspect of this, how we choose to behave and how we react, I teach people this all the time when I teach empathy and emotional regulation. There's a very simple equation. E plus R equals O. The event plus your reaction equals the outcome. You genuinely do predict your own future. And so it's not enough to just say, you know, I'm going to manage my change, but it's also understanding how the factors of resiliency and where those boundaries play and recognizing them and being mature enough to be able to step back and look at the situation and circumstance for what it is and then apply it. That's what truly drives you or pulls you through change. And so this is where some of the greatest coaches are defined, is their ability to tune into a client and see when that person is really showing them the reality or a facade.
You know, you mentioned too that resiliency and our ability to accept change, it's something that that we start learning from the time that we're born. How does our families and our upbringing play a role in that?
Oh, it's quite extensive when you think about that. It starts actually all from birth. When you're brought home from the hospital, does somebody pick you up the second you cry, or do you have to self-soothe? I mean, my parents were fantastic at swaddling me and throwing me into a crib and letting me cry till I fell asleep. I mean, that's back in the day. That's what we used to do, right? And so it starts from proper and adequate attachment, right? Do I get my needs met when I cry? Does somebody pay attention to me when I fall and hurt myself when I'm learning to walk? What do those reactions look like? Am I taught to solve problems as a young child by doing puzzles or building Lego, right? And then from that point, it's how do I deal with conflict on the playground? Is somebody going and dealing with it for me when I tattle? Or is somebody expecting that I'm going to go and have a hard conversation? Right? I mean, I can recall times when I did this with my daughter. You know, she was having an issue with a girl who was trying to, who's a friend of hers in the second grade, and wasn't treating her with respect. And I said to her, you deserve respect. You need to tell your friend that. And she said, okay. And the second grade, she went to this girl and she said, I deserve respect. I don't like how you're treating me. Right. And it was one of those things where as a helicopter parent, you can totally get involved and deal with that.
I can see that. Sure.
But what value are you adding to your children in doing that? Right. I mean, I'm seriously in love with this child and I would lay my life down for her. But at the same time, I'm not going to be here for her entire life. If I don't set her up with the skills to truly solve problems and be a true force to be reckoned with in this world, she's fucked, right? Over the long term. And I don't want to do that to her. Right. So I mean, my dad was very much about that. I mean, my dad was a jail guard for 25 years. So in the Yukon. And so we were pretty much raised by wolves. He was a single parent and we had to fend for ourselves, right? Yeah. My nickname is Mowgli. Right. So,
some of us, we may not have had great tools growing up, and then we find bodybuilding, we find fitness. You find yourself at the bottom of this curve. You know, I want to change. I want to make these drastic changes to my body and, you know, reach this goal, get on stage, whatever it is. You end up at the bottom of this curve. You haven't maybe always been raised with this skill set that you're talking about. What can the listeners do out there, the people that are possibly either in this situation or, you know, looking to apply some New Year's resolutions and might find themselves in this situation before they know it? How can they learn to improve their resiliency?
Well, I think first and foremost, and this is just my learning, I think that having a good quality coach is probably the number one thing that a competitor, a true competitor, somebody who wants to be competitive, what they can do is to have and build that relationship with somebody. And those things don't come overnight, but it's exploring and having somebody that you can truly trust, because you need to have that soundboard. And if not a coach, have a friend, somebody who you can be very honest with. Sitting and cycling in your own head is only going to get you so far. Right. And I think you and I can both really understand and relate that. I mean, you can relate it to your last preps until, you know, you partnered up with Shelby. You were really doing your own thing and you were analyzing every aspect of who you were every single day.
Absolutely.
Right. It's consumable. And so, you know, having that person, that soundboard is number one. The second thing that I would suggest is be realistic. Right? I mean, bodybuilding in itself is an empowering sport. And the things that we love should never cause us infinite pain. Right? So I would never be the one to discourage somebody from competing, but if you're not doing it for the right reasons, why are you doing it?
Yeah.
Right? Where's the value add? And I think that, again, this comes back to social media. If you look, the fitness industry, the bodybuilding industry has completely taken over social media. And maybe that's just through my filter because I am pretty hardcore and that's what I like to see.
That's what I wonder too. As far as my feed is concerned, I'm right there with you though.
But I would look at it, even though, like, I'm on the executive for the IMBF Canada, and I've been on the executive for 8 years, and I've watched our shows go from, you know, two in Alberta to now we're in BC to then we're in Manitoba to then we went to Montreal and we had to scale back again. And what we've seen is a very high number of people who are throwing their hat in the ring to compete. And again, being that I run the backstage for all of these competitions in Western Canada, I can tell you who's going to win the pro card. I can tell you who put their work in. I can tell you who's really great at managing their personal change and following the direction and the guidance of a very good coach. And I can tell you who's not from the second I see them. Right?
Sure.
And so you see the explosion of all of these different things, and you see people who want to participate in it because it's the thing. That's not really what it is. right? It's not just the thing. If you're truly a student of the practice of bodybuilding, and you're truly gunning to be competitive and represent the best interest of the sport and keep it alive and keep it well, your motives are very different. Your ability to manage your change becomes different because it's no longer serving just an aesthetic purpose. It's serving an end game, right? I'm passionate about this. This is a part of my life. It's the fiber and tapestry of who I am.
Yeah.
So I think that, understanding why and why now, why is it important to you, right? And also, the why now, I think, is even more important. When I first started competing, I went into fitness model, and I just wanted to have a new goal. I wanted to keep losing weight. I'm a big loser. I've lost over 100 pounds. And in that, it was, I'm going to do this because it seems like the next natural thing to do. Somebody mentioned it to me, great. Those first two contests for me were the worst experiences of my life. Horrible. I actually had somebody who tweeted me from the audience of my first contest, and he direct messaged me.
Okay.
And he said to me, "You had no place being on that stage."
You're kidding me.
Not at all. He said, "You had no place being on that stage." He said, "There's a very big difference between losing weight and being competitive."
Wow. Wow.
He's not wrong. He's not wrong.
Yeah, you don't say that stuff. Right? Yeah, no kidding. You want to call him out here right on the show?
Well, you know, so being ready to do it, right? Making it a long-term commitment. And that's where I struggle as a female bodybuilder, is that we're seeing a whole bunch of different classes that are popping up. Bikini is huge.
Yeah.
Huge. I'm like, there's like a 10, 20, 30 to 1 ratio.
Absolutely.
Of a bikini competitor to a female bodybuilder. And so when I go to a show, I literally, for me to qualify for pro, I have to have 4 other women to compete against, right? And the likelihood of that is very slim. So I have to go and find saturation points where I can actually do it, right? Where I can be and have competition that's going to be competition. But in this vein, what it comes down to is, you know, had I just coming back to my first competition experiences, had I said, I'm going to take a year and a half or 2 years to really work on my body and come and be in shape, it would have been a completely different experience.
Yeah.
So being realistic, I think, is a very big piece of managing your personal change, right? If you're not mentally and physically capable of going through the grind, you probably shouldn't. You should take the time and prepare yourself and call it pre-contest. Find a coach.
I feel like a lot of times people might set themselves up for failure because they get into this, and like you were saying, you know, you compare yourself on social media, but you see all these different people that are doing all this really cool stuff, and people don't think about that amount of time that it takes when they dive in. They just think, hey, I want to get there, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. People say to me all the time, I don't know where you find the time. Oh, you know what the fundamental is? You get up early, right? If I'm up before the worms, I'm able to pack a lot into my day.
Sure, I'm not even talking about just the time of day. I'm talking about just the amount of time as in years, you know. Back to what you were saying before, you know, you're talking about trying to make these huge changes, but you know, you've been doing this long enough that you've educated yourself. You know, you aren't necessarily going to be able to reach certain goals, you know, within a 1 year period of time or within 18 months.
Absolutely. But I can tell you that when I first started, I was completely unrealistic. Even when I took time away, because I took time away and I went and I played football. I was a linebacker for a women's tackle football team for a couple of years.
Okay.
And, you know, so it's really good to be a skookum woman when you're, you know, you can achieve a lot when you just apply the girth that you have. But to come back, you know, I felt the fittest and the healthiest I'd ever been. And I said to my coach, okay, I'm ready to do this. Let's go. I want to be competitive. And we had like a 16-week window. And she was very honest with me in my first prep. Like, she was like, 16 weeks is nothing when I'm looking at your body type and what we need to do. And if I look at my starting, I like to refer to it fondly as my mom pants picture, where I was in the best shape of my life, and moved from there to where I am now. I'm definitely a truly competitive athlete compared to where I was, but it's taken me 4 or 5 years to get there.
You know, a lot to what I'm thinking here. This reminds me a lot of my own personal story in recovery. You know, I had been in active addiction for a long time, and it was something that I wanted to change. I wanted to change it long before I actually had the willingness to do it. And I came to a realization that wanting to have something and having the willingness to take the action are two totally separate things. Do you come across people that that tell you that they want to change, that they want to meet these goals, but they're just not ready?
Constantly.
How do you deal with that?
And I've got different tools and different pieces in my toolkit that I use, particularly with individuals.
Okay.
And I also apply them in the corporate world. But what I do is I have people identify first and foremost their vision. Where do you want to go? Why do you want to go there? And why do you want to go there now, right? Because once you answer the why and the why now, the how becomes very easy, right? It's a problem-solving exercise. But the why is what drives people's behavior. But then from what I do there, because I can see a poser from a mile, million miles away. Like they're, and I'm sure as a coach, you see that as well. You can see the people who are just truly not committed, who are providing lip service to the end state and the goal that they have. And so what I do is I also implement a values assessment. What that does is it gives me insight into understanding what is important to a person from a mental and an emotional perspective, right? And, you know, the top five things that most people come out with are things like, you know, family, friendships, money, things like that, right?
Okay.
Once I understand those elements plus their why, I can see where they're going to have the fail points. And so depending on what the person's personality is, and I guess it's kind of crass to look at it like this, depending on what the person's personality is, I may not actually even engage with them.
Okay.
Right?
Oh, fair enough.
I've come to a point in my practice where you know where somebody is actually committed and when they're not, when they're going to truly make the change or not. If somebody has a problem for every solution I give them, I deem them to be an asshole, and I'm like, you're done. I my time is worth something, right?
Sure.
And so, but the thing is that, you know, I operate out of complete love, tact, and diplomacy. My objective is never to hurt somebody's feelings or make them feel bad about themselves, but I'm never going to candy coat it. I will very, very honestly tell people, I don't think this is right for you. You're not as committed as you think. Mm. You need to do more soul searching before you're going to be prepared to take this step. And, you know, because a lot of the time when it comes to my life coaching and helping athletes, I don't charge people. I spend my time with people intrinsically. And so if I'm investing intrinsic time in you, then I see the potential of where you can go and what you're capable of doing, right? But yeah, I mean, people who have the big realizations and the ideas and the drive to want to move into a new realm of life, those are a dime a dozen. And, you know, you're going to find a 1 in 10 that's actually going to be successful. And here's the thing. When you're looking at the problem-solving process, somebody's ability to solve their own problem, sometimes getting to a 60% for an average individual is acceptable. And that's okay. If somebody wants to lead their journey and only go 60% of the way to what their goal would have been, they're still better off than they were 60% ago. So I'm willing to support that person, right?
Sure.
It doesn't have to be all or nothing. Change is it's a journey. It really is. And you can understand that. I mean, like, you know, we look at these compulsive behaviors and the things that drive us as bodybuilders. I mean, I, for one, have a very highly addictive personality. And what bodybuilding does for me is it feeds that addiction in a very positive and balanced way.
Yeah.
You know, and I invite that for other people because I think it's a healthy and it's a positive lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, you're talking a little bit about your coaching and how you work with people. Before we actually got to recording, you said something that kind of was interesting to me. You had said that you take the science of all this and then you apply an art to it. Can you explain to us what you mean by this combination of art and science in the work you do?
Absolutely. It's probably my favorite part. The science is the science is the necessity, right? It's the psychology, it's the resiliency factors, it's the structure.
It's kind of everything we've been talking about up to this point, right?
Yes. Yeah. The artistry of that and where it gets really fun is helping people solve problems and being innovative and introducing new concepts, encouraging people to step outside of their comfort zones and having conversations. I call them like the aha conversations, where you can, even when you're over text with somebody, you can see the light bulb go off.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of that comes from, you know, the scientific side of understanding where somebody is, how they behave, all of these different things that are important to them, and then helping them design what that next state looks like. I think that's the artistry, right? So if you do this, you will get this, right? Okay. And as people in the industry, we know, and, you know, as somebody who's lost 100 pounds, I know that if I have a calorie deficit and I introduce more water and better sleep, guess what? I'm going to lose weight. Yeah. It's just, it's science, right? But there's so much that goes on in the fitness industry and on social media and on television. And, you know, we're inundated with a multi-billion-dollar industry that's always looking to make something off of somebody's back. And so if you can take it down and through the artistry of our learnings and what we know to be the truest and easiest way to do things and script it out for somebody, and draw a plan out and give them the vision to go where we know they can go, that's invaluable. And that's where the artistry comes. Now, the thing that's really important, and one of the things, particularly when I work with different coaches and, you know, gym owners and things of this nature, personal trainers, is that I often say that, you know, just because we have a plan to help somebody manage their change to get from point A to point B does not mean that it's going to be easy. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to think that my weight loss should be linear through my whole prep. I've been prepping for 15 weeks and I've only lost 14 pounds. Well, goddamn, that's not the way I planned it.
Okay.
Right? So when we develop a plan for somebody and we have this vision and we've done all of the scientific work, the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to kick the change off. And I liken this to throwing a rock in a pond.
Okay.
One of three things is going to happen. One, we're going to create ripples. And things are just going to flow on, right? Okay, yeah, we're going to be able to handle this. It's an easy go. We often see that at the very beginning of a prep. So say you're cutting somebody for 20 weeks or you're engaging in a 20-week cut. The first couple of weeks are pretty easy, sure. Right? But the secondary that could happen is we're going to cause waves. And when we cause waves, we need to be able to react to that at a pretty quick order. And so that's having more artistic balance in how we communicate and what the expectations are back and forth. You know, we're going to cut your this week. We're going to add an extra supplement of that as well. I want to hear from you in 2 days.
Yeah.
Right? When you do that, you're throwing the rock in. You're probably creating some ripples or waves, and you're going to get feedback from the client, and we're going to be okay. The next and final reaction that we could get is you could throw a rock in, and depending on how that client behaves, you could get a tsunami, right? And you see that in different threads. You see that because, I mean, arguably a lot of coaches, they follow their clients back and forth on social media. So you see the way that somebody's behaving or reacting, or you see, you know, like grayscale posts or things like that, right? That are just, they're indicators that something might not be okay. Or you see completely self-destructive behavior based off of the change, right? And so this is where the science helps us become very artistic in how we actually deal with people and how we help them manage that change. And this is where I think a lot of the coaching industry lacks. Is because, you know, it's check in with me on Monday and I'll hear from you next Monday. Send me pictures, right?
Yeah.
And we have that feeling where maybe I can't reach out if I'm having a hard day. Then you also have certain clients where when you give them the permission or the latitude to reach out, they're in your inbox every day.
Yeah.
Right. And that, so you have to be able to strike a balance and have those conversations to determine what that looks like and create those set points so that you can manage that change in a very artistic way by leveraging the undertones of the science and the different pieces that you know. And so one of the things is with the change curve, this is one of the first things that I introduce to any leader or any athlete that I work with, or any coach for that matter, is because once we understand the science, being able to problem solve as a coach, for example. Coaches are problem solvers. That's what your job is. You're drawing a plan out, and then you're solving the problems as you go. You're looking at the biofeedback. You're looking at the behavior. You're looking at the photos or the posing videos or all of these different things that tell you what needs to change for the next week. And you're taking that and you're solving that problem, right? So then where the resiliency factors and the artistic side start to bleed in is, as a coach, are you able to feel empathy, right? Because, you know, I was talking to a gym owner in Saskatchewan this week while I was away on holidays, and she was saying that she has all these women who really want to lose weight, and they're coming in for group strength training, and it's really great. They think they want to go into powerlifting. One wants to do a figure competition. They come and they knock out these big numbers in the gym, but then they go home, and as soon as their kids are in bed, they go and hide in the closet and eat four boxes of cookies.
Yeah.
And they don't want to talk to her about that because it's shameful. And if you read anything or watch any of the TED Talk videos that Brené Brown does, she does a lot of research and a lot of insight and opinion gathering on shame. And that's a very largely misunderstood area. And what happens is shame in itself is horrible, and it's manifested and it's fed in areas where we feel like we can't talk about things. Yeah. Where if I reveal that I ate the four boxes of cookies, people are going to make me feel really bad about myself. I already feel bad.
Yeah,
right?
I've always kind of said that I feel like guilt is one thing, and it's okay to feel guilty about having done something you weren't supposed to. But then shame is when you let your emotions start to overtake you, and you start feeling bad about it, and it starts eroding away at your self-esteem. That's at least been my take. Is there anything positive about shame?
I think what shame does is it stimulates us to think differently. The guilt, I completely agree with you. Guilt is one thing. We should have a conscience about how we behave and the things that we do. We should also be able to get over that, though. Yeah. And I think guilt is fed by shame.
Okay.
I feel that the positive of shame is that there's recognition in where we have gone wrong. But where the definer is how we manage it. And this is where empathy comes back into play, okay. Right? Empathy, if you were to have two petri dishes and you had, and this is a Brené, like, I'm probably going to bastardize it, but she says, you know, if you have two petri dishes and you have shame in both of them, and one is being fed by hostility and negativity and that constant drive to make someone feel bad about what they've done, Shame just thrives. Like, it just grows and it breeds. But then when you look at it and you were to put it in a petri dish full of empathy and patience and understanding and compassion, that is an incredibly hostile environment for shame. And so as a coach, it's not that empathy does not mean that we don't hold people accountable to their actions. That's not what it means at all. What it means is that we put ourselves in somebody else's shoes and we're willing to look at the world through their eyes. I often say, when it comes to empathy and emotional regulation, the one question that I always consistently ask is, why would a reasonable, rational human being behave like that?
Okay.
And I'd like to believe that a good majority of the population is reasonable and rational, and those who aren't probably should be medicated, neither here nor there.
Yeah.
But when it really comes down to it, taking a second and stepping back and saying, man, I didn't realize that maybe their cat died this week, or, you know, they had 90 hours of work that was loaded on. I can understand why they would have eaten the four boxes of cookies. That really is a shitty decision, but hey, let's talk about it and let's move past it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, again, I come back to the relationship that I have with my coach, and I write her a very extensive, detailed journal every single day just to give her insight into how my day was. Because, you know, I think about the fact that I will work 90 to, you know, 100 hours in a week, depending on my client load. And that certainly adds cortisol to the body. You know, you sleep 4 hours a night, your body is going to be an angry body. Oh, yeah. I traveled 22 out of 31 days this month, right?
Okay.
So all of these factors, if she knows everything that's gone on for me, and I had a really shitty workout, and she looks into my training journal and she goes, oh, that wasn't a very good workout. Hey, you know what? I went in and I did volume instead of weight. That was my thing this week, right? But it's one of those things where she has great insight into how my week has unfolded, so she can make the appropriate changes and recommendations. I don't have to feel shame with her. I can be honest with her, because when I go forward and I share the details, I'm not giving her excuses. I'm telling her what the facts of the week were, right? Have we always been there? No. It's taken us time to get there. And it's taken me a lot of time to be able to frame what that relationship looks like so that I'm getting the maximum output from her.
I got a question for you, and this relates to goal setting. I read Arnold Schwarzenegger once said that early on when he wanted to compete, he would make the decision, okay, I'm going to compete in this show. He said what he would do is he would tell everybody, because it held him accountable. He'd say, hey, I'm competing in this show. He'd let everybody know. And for that reason, he felt like that held him more accountable. People would ask him questions, and then he felt like he had to stick with it. I had a friend of mine say that when she sets goals, she doesn't want to tell anybody, because she feels that if she talks about it too much, then she almost gets a sense of accomplishment. You know, oh, I'm going to compete in this show. And people say, hey, that's great. And, you know, she gets a sense of excitement, and in a way, she never really had to do the show to kind of get the sense of satisfaction of talking about doing the show. I can relate to both of those two things, but just out of curiosity, what are your thoughts about these two methods of goal setting, and how do you compare and contrast them?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, it's interesting because I fall somewhere in between. I can relate to both.
I can too. Yeah.
I find that, you know, it becomes tiresome when somebody is only talking about their goal.
Yeah. Right? And, like, and I feel like we get that a lot nowadays. Many people tell me how much they grind and how hard they work. Yet I don't see them, you know, they want to work with me, and then I don't see them for their whole off season, and then they get a hold of me at 16 weeks out. What changes have you made? You know, well, realistically, maybe you're a little bit better, but did you really reach your potential? Well, all I saw on social media for the last 5 months was you eating burgers, you know?
Absolutely. And that is, again, it comes right back to my initial point of the drive around social media and how people live through that lens. Right.
Yeah.
And it erodes people's ability to truly manage change and be resilient contributors to their own lives. Because we inherently show people what we want people to see. Right. And, you know, you get these people who have tunnel vision on their goals. There's no balance to them, right? They're very one-sided. And I find when I was first competing, I was obsessed with sharing this. I'm going to do this. This is going to be great. You guys are going to be all so proud of me. Check out the food I'm eating. And it's like, it gets really tiresome very quickly. And people disengage. The other thing is, yeah, I can agree that it holds you accountable to that goal. It creates a level of commitment that is very social. The downside to that is if you are not successful, it is very damaging to your self-esteem and your self-confidence. And so, you know, again, I go back to my very first contest, and this guy, I'm up on the stage, I'm feeling fit and fine, I'm 105 or 110 pounds down, I'm strutting my shit, I've got these little heels on, I'm doing a fitness model. Honest to God, it was not good. But, you know, I did it. And I placed dead last, 9 of 9. I received this horrific message, and it took me a long time to recover from that. Right? I had a really broken heart because I thought that I was bringing something that was truly competitive. But again, I didn't understand what I was fully engaging in.
Yeah.
I didn't know the why, and I didn't know the why now. I didn't have a vision. I just knew that this was a possibility because I paid somebody my $65 and bought my membership card.
Yeah.
You know, no promoter's ever going to say no. They don't care what you look like.
Oh God. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I scaled back, and when I came back into the arena and I started bodybuilding, I got into it a little too much again. And I was sharing and I was oversharing, but I was not as explicit as I was during my first two preps. And in the end, you know, I was actually going to do 3 shows in fitness model when I first started out, and I ended up having to scale back from the third one and just completely drop it out because it was not mentally the right thing for me to do. So I also know competitors who will prep for shows and not tell a soul.
Yeah.
And I think about that and I think, gosh, how lonely would that be? You know, why wouldn't you want to celebrate your victories?
Yeah.
Who doesn't want to see your double bicep shot? I mean, you know, it's just, you have to find a balance of what's acceptable and what's not. Do I want to see you doing cardio every single day? Absolutely not. Because you know what? I know you're doing it. Who cares?
Right.
Great. You're part of the movement, right? But when it comes to a significant achievement or hitting that milestone or, you know, seeing striations in your delts. Yeah. You know what? I want to see that. I want to celebrate with you because that is awesome.
Yeah.
Right. And even though you might be my competition, that doesn't mean that I wish you any ill will. In terms of where I sit personally now, I'm definitely a, work in silence and celebrate the success as it comes.
Right? I like that.
You know, I don't think anybody needs to know what my cardio routine is or what my macronutrients are or the fact that I eat a chicken and guacamole salad every day for lunch because that's just part of my meal plan. Like, people don't care.
Yeah.
Right? You know, and again, you see the fact that there's stories on Instagram and stories on Facebook and Snapchat and all of these different overlapping things that give people way to share whatever they want to see or what they want to show. And, you know, for me, I segregate my social media. So LinkedIn is purely 100% professional. If we don't have a professional relationship, you're not on my LinkedIn. If it's Facebook, Facebook is very family focused. I have a lot of my IMBF competitors on there. I have a lot of family because I've, you know, I've changed the way that I use my Facebook. Instagram is 100% dedicated and devoted to my bodybuilding, 100%. Okay. And it is my journey in photos that are relevant to me and what I do want to show off, because let's be honest, bodybuilding is a sport where we work hard and we earn the right to really display the fruits of our labor. Yeah. And I want to share that. I want to inspire other people. But, you know, moreover, I want to be able to look back and inspire myself. Because
I
think is an amazing driver, right? To look back and go, holy shit, 7 months ago, my biceps were half an inch or an inch smaller.
Yeah.
Right? Or looking at your, you know, and again, I look at it and I've got my Instagram theme to the point where I can look down the picture line and there's only one selfie every three posts. Right. And so I see the differences and it's cool. Right. But it helps me stay accountable to my goals, where it's not about placing my goals out there for everybody else to hold me accountable, because the only person who really matters is myself, because I'm the one who has to sleep with myself, whether I meet or miss those goals.
Yeah.
I think we place too much on what other people think and what other people want to see of us, right? It's a self-confidence thing.
We're about out of time here. Is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you think is really important for the listeners to take home from this?
You know, I think this is a really good starting point. I'd be really interested in hearing feedback and what other people think about the concept, because these are new concepts. We don't talk about these things in the bodybuilding world. We don't talk about these things in the business world.
Yeah, right? I think that people are feeling this stuff, and I think we're going through it. Like you said, you know, in the beginning, we were talking about these steps of change, whether you want to admit it or not, whether you are in touch with yourself enough or not. I think we're all feeling that stuff, but are we recognizing it and able to see it? I don't know. So, and that's kind of what I'm hoping here. I'm hoping that maybe we can bring that to light a little bit more and maybe get people thinking.
Absolutely. Especially if we come into the new competition season, you know, making sure that I think people are taking care of themselves, because my concern with unhealthy people who are mentally unwell because they don't understand their personal change or they don't understand their resiliency factors is that they erode the credibility of our sport. And they erode based off of the fact that they go and they have a bad experience or they develop an eating disorder.
Yeah. We talk about that a lot on the shows, you know, and it's all the way back to, yeah, like you said, the people who show up and maybe shouldn't have competed. And then I see the other side of it too, where maybe people have forced themselves and had a bad experience post show. And then they dislike the idea. They see the sport as just being unhealthy and now their metabolism's messed up. And then they just write bodybuilding off or, you know, bikini off for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely. I think there's, to be completely honest, I think we could apply this whole concept to reverse dieting in a completely different way. And I think that's a show topic unto itself, is the appropriate reversal and using these tools and how you can leverage them as a competitor, as a coach, to truly manage that experience coming out of a competition.
Well, I think that it sounds like we have a goal set up for the future. Then we'll have to bring you back and talk about that, especially, you know, after all these contests happen, people are going to need that information.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, it's one of those things post-contest, even if somebody chooses not to reverse with a coach, having the skill sets and the tools available to them is absolutely crucial to their personal success and, you know, their next competition experience, or reintegrating back into a lifestyle that doesn't permit competition, right? And that's okay too.
So, Kate, how can people reach out to you if they wanna inquire about your services, or if they just wanted to pick your brain, ask questions, or if they wanted to follow your prep?
I think if the best way is on Instagram. That's my primary feedback mechanism on bodybuilding. And my handle there is Kate, K-A-I-T underscore D-E-E, Kate D. And I encourage folks to reach out to me and follow along. I'd love to have people along for the journey.
Well, awesome. Kate, thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it. And I hope, like I said, I hope that we get people thinking maybe about some of the aspects of their lives that they aren't quite paying attention to.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Scott. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Guys, for Advices Radio, I'm Scott McNally with Kate D'Annunzio. Have a great year, and we will be talking to you very soon.